Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us should be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. It's a great honor to introduce our speaker tonight. I've heard him share at meetings. I know he does a lot of service work. How about a big hand for Christian?
Being introed by Tinsley. That's pretty cool. Sorry, as often as I get the privilege of sharing my experience, Strength and Hope, I'm always nervous. I hope I'm never not. So let me just kind of loosen up a little bit. Yeah, I used to be at concerts and people would pass these outside issues to me. Anybody who's been to the particular concerts I'm speaking about knows what they're passing. My experience is they never passed you crap. They always wanted to share something of worth, so hopefully I do that tonight. My name is Christian Proctor. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 7th, 2001. And that wasn't the first time I came and graced the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I sure hope it's the last time. I first visited you guys back in March of 1998. And it was at the end of my fifth suicide attempt. I'm bad at suicide, man. I mean, I have lost at that, you know. Like Chuck Chamberlain, you know, I failed as an alcoholic. You know, I was like, I couldn't master this thing. But in March of 1998, I hit a bottom. Let me paint that picture for you. I'm the oldest of three kids. My dad worked for a major company, which is based in Atlanta. So we moved around a lot, and I was always in some place just long enough to get to know you, and then I had to leave. And so I never really built those, I guess you would call them foundational relationships. I never had, like, my best friend forever. You know, I didn't have those old friends, you know. And you know, we would always say the words, you know, hey, man, all right. This is before email. I'd keep up with writing somebody. But at some point in time, I found that in a letter format, you can be very dishonest. So, like, I'm writing my friends back in Miami, Florida, and I'm telling them all about how the girls are in Atlanta, and, oh, my God, you guys ain't got nothing like that down in Miami, and you should really come up here. And that's my letters at age of, like, 11. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here sharing these fanciful experiences. The problem is, you kind of have to remember the lie, because when they came and visited, dude, remember your letters? Where's all this stuff you were talking about? And I was like, oh yeah. Where's that huge video game system that you have? Oh yeah. You don't have a motorcycle? Oh yeah. I found that I was really bad at lying. But it's funny, it served me. Lying served me. My first conscious lie was when I was about 4, maybe 5 years old, and my brother and I were roughhousing in the house. All right? My mom still had things called breakables. She doesn't have them anymore, but she did at that point in time. And we were doing things like jumping on couches and throwing pillows and chasing each other around. And at some point in time, a pillow was flung or thrown or something. Maybe my brother was thrown, and it hit one of those nice plates. Like I said, she used to have nice stuff. And she hears this from the kitchen. And the first thing she does is she goes, what was that? She comes out, she looks right at me, and she looks right at my brother, and she goes, who broke my plate? And I swear, I looked her dead in the eyes. I said, Sean did. And boy, he got a whooping, and I found out that, you know what? If you lie, you get out of trouble. And I started to hone my craft. You know, I've already told you about my experience with the letters. But I found that, like, the face-to-face lies worked really well for me because I actually started to believe the lie. You know those mornings you would wake up or come to, whatever you want to call it, and you would, like, crawl out from the azalea bush you may have slept under the night before, and you're thinking to yourself, man, that was, what happened last night, you know? And then people will come up and start telling you things that, dude, when everybody else left, you were off the chain, man. What the hell did I do, man? Oh, man, you know, and they would tell you these stories. I have to kind of base my truth on a lot of the stories that they shared with me. The weird thing is that I hung around with people who like to live the way I like to live. And they like to drink the way I like to drink. And my first drink was when I was, because it helps to have a first drink to get here, and that's been my experience. My first drink was when I was a freshman in high school. My first conscious drink, I'll put it that way. I had sips from Budweiser, and, you know, my dad would get those tiny little airplane bottles, you know, the kind that's just enough in there to piss you off, you know, and I would drink the Golden Galliano, anything that tasted like cough syrup. I loved cough syrup. Anybody? Cough syrup? Yeah. I loved cough syrup because I loved the effect it had on me. I didn't realize that you could abuse it, or I would have. But my first conscious drink was when I was a freshman in high school. And I demonstration is because freshman in high school, I hadn't gone through puberty yet. Anybody not gone through puberty yet? All right. I guess you all have. But when you're a freshman in high school and all your friends are like 5'7", 5'8", 5'10", 6 foot, I mean, they're giants. I was 4'9". And nothing on me had grown yet. No hair down there. It was like the worst feeling in the world. And I felt different. Now, I felt different before freshman year, but after the summer and freshman year started, everybody got taller. They had hair on body parts. I mean, their voice got deep. I mean, it just freaked me out. I was sitting there walking around with my little squeaky voice, you know. I'm trying. And I was a class clown because I figured if you're laughing with me, you're not laughing at me. Turns out you were laughing at me. But I tried so hard to fit in. I tried so hard to be accepted. And I knew I wasn't. And then right before Thanksgiving, I found my way at a high school party. And you guys know what they do at high school parties, right? Yeah. My basis for high school parties was Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Porky's. They didn't do any of that stuff there. But they were doing a lot of stuff that I'd never done. They were smoking out of these particular glass tubes from non-habit forming outside issues. And I learned at that party, you do not cough into that tube. everywhere. They were shotgunning beer. And that looked really attractive, mostly because there was a lot of people doing it. That's the reason I wanted to do it. I wanted to be a part of. And you know the idea of shotgunning a beer, right? You grab a pen, you grab a beer, that's all you need. Pop, pull, and it runs down, right? In theory, that's a very easy idea to comprehend, right? Well, if you don't put your mouth real tight around the base of the can, it will run down the front of your shirt, and then subsequent laughter ensues. And then you're feeling like a dick, you know? And you're really pissed off at all your friends, but see, I'm not a quitter. It's the reason I make a great alcoholic. I'm not a quitter. I pushed through the embarrassment. I pushed through the humiliation. I grabbed another beer. I bit into the bottom of that damn can. And you know what happened when all that beer splashed into the bottom of my virgin stomach? This 4'9" frame of mine started to grow. All of a sudden, I looked down, and the floor is like 6 feet, 2 inches below me. These shoulders started to spread. My voice got very deep, and I felt like Barry White all of a sudden. And then I found myself looking, we got hair. We've got hair down there. Oh, yeah. And when I say everything grew on me, my confidence grew. My ego got very large. I felt very comfortable doing what I was doing with people who just 2 minutes ago I felt like I didn't belong with. And I was funny and I was articulate. And all the women wanted to be with me. Now, I'm telling you, this is a perception thing. It wasn't really what happened. But all the women wanted to be with me and all the men envied me. And none of that happened because when I woke up around the toilet, which was going to be a very common theme for me, I was 4'9" again, no hair, and inadequate. But something magic had happened the night before. I can't tell you how many beers I drank. I know I drank more than two. I know I was introduced to the joys of Cisco. Any Cisco drinkers? All right, let's go down the path. Any Thunderbird drinkers? What's the word, Thunderbird? Any Wild Irish Rose drinkers? All right, yeah. I love the fortified wines, man, because they're easy to steal. I learned that when I was about 17, 18. And so at age 14, I've learned two things. Number one, I'm not enough, and if I drink enough of that, I can be enough. And so I proceeded every chance I could. And at 14, where I came up in East Cobb County at the time, it wasn't that easy to get it. A lot easier to get outside issues than it was to get alcohol. But every chance I could, I did it. I was a straight-A student. before that episode. And when I dropped out of high school at the age of 17, because it seemed like a good idea, I was hard, strong D's and incompletes and failing in most other classes. And I dropped out because school was getting in the way of work and getting in the way of drinking. And I worked to make money so I could buy stuff to drink and outside issues. You know, I did. That's the only reason I did it. And me and my buddies decided we're going to move into a place over in Chamblee. It took us about a week to figure out we were the only white guys in the complex, but it was a $410 a month apartment. All right, that should tell you how crappy this place was. And I had difficulty coming up with $102.50 a month to pay my rent. I ended up having to pawn the title of my car, ended up losing the car, you know, because, see, drinking and all these other outside issues just kept getting in the way. These are great little warning signs, you know. We're not quitters, though. Most normal people would be like, losing my vehicle? Nah. Getting kicked out of a place to live? Nah. You know, I never got a DUI. I never caught a case. So I don't know. Maybe if the legal thing had come down, maybe I would have, but I didn't. I burned my credit when I was 18 years old because I figured if there was checks in the checkbook, that meant there was money in an account. It took me a weekend to destroy my credit, to lose banking privileges for the next 7 years. It's taken me almost 7 years to repair that credit. Easy come, I guess, but it took a little while to get it back. But what y'all have taught me in the disciplines of this 12-step process is how to repair my credit honestly and how to do it through hard work and perseverance. Buddy of mine decided to show up one day, and he said, "Hey, I'm going on tour with the Dead." I was like, "Who are they?" And he said, "That's okay, you'll like them." And yeah, I did. I loved them. Actually, I loved who went on tour with the Dead, because y'all like to drink and do all these outside issues, you know, the kind of trips where you never leave the room. Did all kinds of stuff, man. Had a blast, I'm told, because I had to rely on all my friends to say, "Dude, last night, stupid, all that window pane, what the hell were you thinking?" They had to peel you off the ceiling of the Omni, man. And if you know that kind of experience, man, it's like you could probably attest to the fact that you can see how weird I am. So I did all this stuff and I had a great experience with that. And, you know, and then I came back to Atlanta after that tour and, you know, I decided I wanted to, like, live in, decided to move to South Carolina. We moved to Columbia, South Carolina. I lived there for about 6 hours. It sucked. So we moved then to Myrtle Beach and I worked two jobs so I could support my drinking and again, paying about $150 a month for rent, living with a whole bunch of guys who worked the season down there, and I kept losing things. You know, I remember a fight where I lost a couple teeth. I kept losing money. You know, it was in there, and now it's not in there. And I never saw that there was a correlation between possibly I have a problem. I just mismanage things. You know, I used to believe this, that users lose drugs. You know, and if you can relate to the users lose drugs kind of mentality, that's where I was. I just lost money. I lost stuff. I lost opportunity. I lost freedom. You know, every now and then I'd be sitting in a drunk tank. But I never correlated that maybe I have a problem with this. When I was 25 years old, had an experience, it was the fifth suicide attempt. Now, prior to my fifth suicide attempt, I'd been living on the streets of Atlanta for 19 months. And I can honestly tell you, I chose to be there. Jobs got in the way. Rent got in the way. Relationships got in the way. I can't tell you honestly when I lost integrity. I don't know when I lost trust. I don't know when I lost relationships. But I know along the way, at some point in time, I made a decision to do what I wanted to do. And see, that's the way I believed it. I really believed I was making decisions. If anybody has alcoholism, they know that the decisions were being made for me. And how come I, like, anytime I argued with myself, you know what, maybe I should pay my rent today. How come I never won that argument? You know, it's like, I love the way Earl Hightower tells the story. He's like, you know, you're in your head, you go, should I, shouldn't I, should I? And my disease is like in the back of my head going, you can believe all day and all night that you have a choice in the matter, but we're going to drink. You know, and that was how my brain fired. It's just, it said this stuff to me. And you know what's really weird is that when I was drinking, everything fit. Everything was enough until I got to that place in March of 1998 when I was 25 years old. And page 25 gives a really cool description of it. And I think it's an amazing description. They don't define alcoholism in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They describe it. I'm really grateful they don't definitively label it as one thing or another, because everybody in here has got some tweak to their story that's a little different. Some of you were tweakers too. But it says, if you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And then it gives this statement, and I turned it into a question. If I have passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, it's from the list. Mom, dad, a couple aunts and uncles, some members of my dad's church, lots of psychiatrists and lots of psychologists, many, many pre-Al-Anon women, many alcoholic women, and they all tried. They all tried. Employers. I was a diligent worker. And they tried. They believed in me. They tried to help me. And I was beyond their aid. But then it makes the statement, if I have passed into the region from which there's no return through human aid, I have but two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I could. Let's look at that. My end in March of 1998, now notice my sobriety day is until 2001, but my March of 1998 may have been the worst physical bottom that I would accept. I had been living on the streets of Atlanta for 19 months. I had lost 14 teeth doing what we do. Trying to get over on people who are smarter than you isn't a good thing to do. And I was living behind a dumpster off Marietta Street. If you know where the Salvation Army Red Shield is off Marietta Street, there at the corner of Marietta and Mills, if you literally look right across the street, those now nice lofts were at the time really crappy cat holes. And they're just, I mean, drug dens, and that's where winos and bums hung out. And you would have found me behind it, sleeping behind a dumpster. And I had enough cardboard situated, and I had gone down to this Euro shop that had all these little aluminum foil wrappers, and I would steal them along with food that I got out of the dumpster, and I would make a shift, almost like an oven. So when that little can of Sterno or those couple candles that I lifted from the dollar store would keep me warm enough on those nights where it wasn't below 41 degrees, and I would stay as warm as I possibly could. Now the thing is, if alcohol continued to work for me, I don't know that I would be here. I may have been still there. I probably found a toothless girlfriend, and you know, and if somebody low enough on the scale to want to hang out with me, I would have been good. But that's not where I was. Alcohol stopped working. I saw, and we call it a moment of clarity. Anybody familiar with that allergy commercial that shows this hazy screen and then it's clear? Well, for us, we have these filters on our eyes, the way we perceive the world around us. Because see, when I drank, my life wasn't that bad. 13 teeth, 14 teeth lost, that ain't that bad. No money, that ain't that bad. Because see, I got enough booze to keep me going. I got a little place to stay. Nobody's bothering me back there. I mean, nobody was bothering me. Nobody wanted to go back there. That's how bad that place was. I mean, it stunk. And I couldn't smell it. Because see, the alcohol covered up the smell. I could effectively blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. Anybody who was normal would have looked at that and said, hell no. I was going, what the hell is your problem? Why are you making fun of my house, man? this is where I kick it, you know? And there ain't nothing wrong with that. But on March 20th, 1998, I found myself doing some stupid things with some rather, I want to say they're stupid people, but they were smarter than I was. And I did like all heroes do, and I came crashing home to Mom. And I was back in East Cobb County looking like hell. I was about 108, 109 pounds soaking wet. I told you I already had teeth kicked in. I had stuff living on me, which is not a stretch. I then proceeded, while she let me in, and she could have definitely benefited from Al-Anon, because she should have not let me in. But I robbed her blind. Took her engagement ring, took a whole bunch of stuff that she had. So I mean, any room that she didn't go in, that was the pilfering room for me. TVs and computers and stereos and all this stuff. And I'm going to a place and I'm doing what I have to do to keep myself going. And I hit a bottom in March 25th, 1998, and I can't go on. My dad, who was on business on the other side of the planet over in Dubai, which is in the United Arab Emirates, he's over there working. He's coming back the next day. He's going to realize there's stuff missing, you know, and the jig is up. So I took an overdose of my mom's medications with the whole intention of dying. And I took a whole bunch of I took a whole bunch of medication that's supposed to keep you from your, keeps your blood thin. It's a blood thinner. And I took a whole bunch of that, a whole bottle of it, because I read that if you took too much, you could bleed internally. Your vessels become too brittle and you'll bleed internally. That sounded like a good plan, good way to die. Then I freaked out a little bit, so I took her Prozac too, you know, kind of calmed me down. And I thought, this shit might hurt. So I took all of her Darvastatin that she had from a kidney surgery. And I'm thinking, there's just not enough pills in this little dish. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, I need more pills in here. And I'm not a pill guy. I'm not doing this to get high. I'm doing this to die. You know, I got a reminder on my right wrist from when I was 15 years old. I've had two or three suffocation attempts. I got one where, you know, running the hose in the car. This is it. I figured this is foolproof. Can't escape from this one. Now, you know that bottom where you can't imagine anything? That you just want to die a whole lot more than you want to live? That's where I was at. And I grabbed that last bottle, and I shouldn't have. It's Lasix. It's a diuretic. It makes you pee a lot. So as I'm washing down handfuls of these pills, and I took the whole dish with big bottles of Magnum malt liquor, I have to get up every 5 minutes from my deathbed to go piss. That's a really kind of humbling place to be, man. You know, you're just sitting there going, why can't I just die in peace? God! Yeah, I'm just feeling this, like, angst, you know? I got my Walkman, you know, I got Prince's Purple Rain. I'm going to go out in the middle of the big swan song part of the song, you know? Oh, that's it. Oblivion. No more. And then I woke up the next morning, and I didn't plan on that. God had another plan. I woke up and I had blood coming out of any hole that I have on my body, blood was coming out of. And it freaked me out, dude. I was like, ah! And so I called my mom. She raced home. She picked me up, took me to the hospital. They immediately put me in 4-point restraints and locked and handcuffed me. So I couldn't move my arms at all. And apparently it's against the law to kill yourself, too. I didn't know that one. That was a bad spot, man. Because, see, even in the middle of that, I still wanted to die a lot more than I wanted to live. And then I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at that Red Shield Lodge over at the Salvation Army. And I'm sorry to say that if there was there was love being shared in that meeting, I didn't hear it. If there was steps being talked about in the meeting, I didn't hear it. I had a head chock full of alcoholism, which brings me to an important point. What makes me an alcoholic is my bodily and mental reactions to alcohol. That once I bring in alcohol into my system, and I've since read the internet, there's a whole new ways of doing it now. But if I drink alcohol, it sets off in me an allergic reaction. Once I start, I can't stop. The downside of that is that I can't seem to not pick it back up, which is the mental obsession. That's what makes me an alcoholic. I quickly found out what alcoholism is when I stopped drinking. Alcoholism is the way I have embraced the world. Alcoholism is that fear, that low-grade anxiety, that restless, irritable discontentedness. That's alcoholism for me. Alcoholism will lead me back to a drink. And when I start drinking, that alcoholic aspect of me kicks in. But see, alcoholism is treated by alcohol. The same thing that was killing me is the same thing that treats my disease. That's a bad place, man. I'm screwed if I do, and I'm screwed if I don't. Because if you've not treated your alcoholism with a 12-step process, you understand the restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness I'm talking about. You understand that feeling of angst, that feeling of like, what's your problem? You know, just looking at people, and they're like, dude, you can really use a drink. You know? When we say that to somebody, that's screwed up. Because that means that this person who is not treating their disease is treating them. And I've since learned, step one doesn't say I can't drink. Step one doesn't say that at all. Step one says I'm going to drink, no matter how great the necessity or wish. Because that is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we understand it. The utter inability to leave it alone. I can't not drink. Not successfully. I can go for a day, a week, or a month, but I can't stay sober one day at a time for the rest of my life because step one is going to kill me. It will drive me insane until I pick up a drink, which is the most insane thing that I could possibly do. So I need a solution. Thank God the program of Alcoholics Anonymous gives us just that. My first sponsor, Don. Some of y'all might know Don. You know, Don, man, Don. wears glasses all the time, man. Shades, even in the middle of the night. You know? Don was hips looking cool, man. And Don, he shared with me an important message. He didn't tell me I didn't have to drink again. That's not the first thing he told me. He didn't tell me I have to go to meetings for the rest of my life. He didn't tell me that I could recover from alcoholism through this 12-step process. He actually hit me with something that I don't know that we share enough. He said, Christian, you don't ever have to be alone again. And then it dawned on me how alone and separate I had been from everybody and everything. I isolated myself so tightly in alcoholism because I didn't want other people to be burdened by my disease. I didn't know it was a disease. I thought it was a lifestyle choice. Dumpster diving is not a lifestyle choice. It really isn't. Now, my story, by the way, being homeless and all that other stuff, doesn't make me a worse alcoholic. That's just where my alcoholism took me. So my first time in AA, all I did was go to meetings. I sat in meetings, and for about an hour, hour and a half, maybe 2 hours every day, I would get a little window of relief, and then I'd go back up to my bunk at the Salvation Army and slowly go insane. Again, if they were talking about steps, I didn't hear it. If they were talking about sponsorship, I didn't hear it. And I guess we don't hear until we hear. Because when I relapsed, I never saw it coming. I stayed drunk for over a year and a half. And now my bottom, before it came in this time, was totally different. I was gainfully employed. I just won the coveted Employee of the Month award. You got to have goals, you know. Some people's goals are like marriage, family, a house, a career. Mine was Employee of the Month award because it meant that I was somebody. That's how twisted my logic was before I got it. And I picked it up and I remembered I got the little check for $250 and I got the little parking decal for a vehicle I couldn't possibly hope to own. And I remember thinking to myself, I've peaked. It's all downhill from here. And it scared the hell out of me. And I went back to where I was staying and I found that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, prior to this moment, in any AA meeting, I was what you would call, or like Don liked to call it. Are we allowed to cuss? Don called me. He said, oh, you one of them good sharing motherfuckers, ain't you? You ain't got shit to share, but you gonna share it, ain't you? You know? I was a regurgitator. I was a parrot. I would hear something at one meeting, I would bring to another meeting, and then I would act like, yeah, I came up with that. You know, and people would be like, oh, that's good sharing, you know? Now, I didn't have anything to share. All I did was talk. I wasn't bringing anything to the table. I had no solution. But boy, I could dress up the trash can and make it look good. And when I came back, my book made this weird noise, which led me to believe I had never opened it. It went... And I realized I hadn't done what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous talked about. And that's when I found Don at the Heavy Hitters Group. And I'm just going to suggest for your consideration, if I had known what the Heavy Hitters Group was like, I probably wouldn't have gone. Because it took me about 10 minutes of a quick study to figure out that I was a lone white guy there. You know, I'm sitting in the meeting, and I was like... There ain't no other white guys here. I know how to be different. I can be different in a room full of different people, man. And this is just, I felt like I didn't belong. No problem with black folks. Had no problem with that. Had no problem with all men's meeting. Had no problem with that. I just had a problem with being the only white guy, you know? And then I proceeded to try to share. 33 days sober. Ain't got no sobriety. I'm clean. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I am free from the effects of drugs and alcohol. That's all I got going. I thought I had some stuff to share. And I tried to. About 30 seconds in, they told me to shut the up. You ain't got nothing, man. We know how to drink. You don't know how to get sober. And what they did after the meeting is they put their arm around me and they said, Christian, we're glad you came, but you really need a sponsor. And I was like, how do they know? So I got Don, and I picked Don because of the car he drove. It turns out it wasn't his car. But you got to have standards. And Don got me into the big book, and he got me into the steps. And I helped discover, by the way, I was about maybe 60 days in recovery before I understood what it meant to be an alcoholic. I went to meetings because that's what people do, right? You all just go to meetings. And that's also where the van took us, was to the meeting. So we went to the meeting. Didn't understand what it meant to be alcoholic. I learned in this room on a Sunday afternoon beginner's meeting, 2:00. Somebody walked up to me and they posed a question. And I loved the question. When unfortunately, I don't know if we ask it enough. What are you doing here? The van dropped me off. You know what they did? Two old timers did? They qualified me. They asked me two very important questions. I said, Christian, when you honestly want to, can you quit entirely? I had a difficulty with the word entirely. What do you mean entirely? Entirely, for good and all. Can you quit and stay quit? No. When drinking, Christian, do you have any control over the amount you take? And then I tripped up. Sometimes. Really? How often? Maybe one out of every 25 or one out of every 30. He says, okay. And then he took me to the park. And he said, Christian, at certain times, the alcoholic has no effective mental defense against the first drink. At certain times, the allergy can be satisfied with a few drinks. At certain times. See, I can't predict. And what they were doing is helping me discover my own truth. They didn't label me an alcoholic, and they didn't accuse me of being an alcoholic. What they did is they asked me a very pertinent question. This is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may help solve their common problem and help others to... I mean, that's the whole point of what we do in here, is to help others to recover from alcoholism. But the cool thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you kind of have to be... you have to suffer from the disease to kind of get in the door. We have one of the highest requirements to get into this club. I mean, you've got to burn your life to the ground almost in order to even get through the door. Now, I'm going to suggest you have to almost burn it down before you even want to come through the door, because I haven't met one person who's walked in going, all right, hey, coffee, yeah, chips, where's that white chip? No, we come in here with our tail between our legs, man, beaten into a state of reasonableness. The cool thing is, man, is if I had known what it is that y'all had, I would have seized it long before. I would have seized it the first time I came in 1998. But I didn't. Now, I don't know if it was because the people there in the meetings, and you have to just remember, the meetings I went to at the Salvation Army, and this is before people were bringing meetings in. Thank you for those who take meetings into the detoxes and treatment centers, any kind of sober living homes. Thank you. If you take meetings in, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Because you're carrying the torch of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're blazing the path for those who need to find a way out. Because there is a darkness of Alcoholics Anonymous that not enough people are bringing the light of AA and the light of God into. You know? But what I would hear in these meetings, and again, this is what I heard, it doesn't mean exactly what was said, is the old timers, you know, the people with 90 days, you know, they were sitting on the outside, and they were holding us new guys in, and we're vibrating, and, you know, we got that half cup of coffee, yipping it all over the place, you know. Can't be trusted, can't, you know, we get like the small tasks, like cigarette butts, cleaning ashtrays, you know. And, I don't know that it was being shared. I'm over the top. You know, people say, you know, Christian, you're way too animated. This isn't a pep rally. And I'm here to say, yes, it is. Because I know where to go to bitch and complain about my life. The same bartender is still sitting at that bar waiting on me to show up and to share my tale of woe. And he will gladly listen. My sponsor will also sit out in the parking lot and listen to me share my tale of woe. But when I walk into this room, I need to have a little bit of hope. Because, see, there's somebody in here whose life is much worse than mine. And I learned that one the hard way. My sponsor is a dick. I hope Don doesn't get pissed off at that. My first sponsor, man, because I'd walk right up to him. I'd be like, you know, Don, I need to talk. You know, I got like, you know, chapped lips or hangnails, you know, real problems. That girl at detox isn't talking to me yet, you know. You know, I have real problems, right? And Don would be like, no. You see that guy in the corner? He's having a much worse day than you. Why don't you go talk to him? And I did it. And guess what happened? That guy didn't want to talk to me. I don't know if it's you or not, but the guy there at the triangle did not want to talk to me. But that didn't matter. That wasn't the assignment. And I went over there and we just talked, and he said, ask him this question. Say, hey, how are you doing? And then listen. Don't wait to interject how you're doing, because I know you want to talk about you. You have this magic magnifying lens of the mind that wants to focus on the smallest little dirt mound and make it into Mount Everest. These huge burning issues you got, which is all you could focus on. Why don't you go focus on him? Shit. So I went over and focused on this guy for 5 minutes. You know what happened when I turned around after that guy finished talking? I had a smile on my face. Don looks right at me and he goes, gotcha. What do you want to talk about? Whatever was eating my ass 5 minutes ago, I could not recall. I actually had to think about what it was that may have been bothering me. He could have told me that intensive work with another alcoholic, even early in sobriety, is imperative for us to stay sober. He could have told me that and would have been like, He had to force me to do it. And that's how I learned the secret of AA is not just in the 12-step process, but in helping others through the 12-step process. Being of service, those who show up early and make the coffee and greet people and set up chairs and put out literature, thank you. I'm one of you. I show up early because that's what I was taught to do. I show up early. I wear a suit behind the podium because that's what I was taught to do, to show respect, not because I wanted to dress like the defendant, even though sometimes I felt like the defendant wearing a suit. You know, before I got sober, the only time I wore a suit was to go in front of some kind of representative of some legal entity in order to try to stay out of trouble. You know, since I've gotten sober, I wear suits to weddings. I wear suits to my wedding. I wear suits to family occasions and to all kinds of things. I also wear them to funerals, you know, and I wear them here. This is a celebration of life, but we have a life-threatening illness, and my hope is that maybe I jump a little loud. Maybe something I say gets through that thickness of alcoholism that we all have. It inspires, man, because a candle loses nothing but lighting another candle. I had a problem with God when I got here. I got a Roman Catholic mom and a Southern Baptist dad. Yeah, you can do the math. That's friction in that household. They yelled at each other in the name of God. They would refuse to go to each other's church. I'd go to my mom's church and it was like you could hear a pin drop. I mean, the noise of your feet on the ground was like echoing. My dad's church was like a town hall meeting. You know, everybody's laughing and cutting up and getting to know each other and all talk about God. And everyone wants to sing and pray. And that's just my dad's church. My mom's church, oh, you walk in, you genuflect. I didn't know what a genuflect was. I just did that, you know. And got there and started praying. And I didn't know what to pray, so I just kind of played with the beads, you know. And then they all got up and they did something. And would go take part of what they call the sacraments. I didn't know what the sacraments were. All I know is they got to eat and drink something and I had to stay put because I hadn't gone through catechism. Now, again, that don't mean shit. What it meant to me is that I'm different. Everybody else is going up. I could almost see the little kids going over. Is he a heathen, mommy? You know, that poor bastard sitting back there all by himself. You know, and I'm thinking to myself at like even 8 or 9, I could probably use a drink. You know, I mean, this sucks. If I had known it was wine, I would have probably disobeyed my mom and jumped in line. The God thing was difficult because I couldn't separate God from religion. I didn't understand that religion is a construct of mankind. The religion began when man put a pen to paper or shared a tale with another. It's carried on through oral and written tradition. I got no problem with religion today. But when I got here, I did. And it was going to be the biggest stumbling block. And my sponsor, Don, looked right at me and he goes, okay, obviously your own conception of God sucks. So let's work on a new conception. You can do that. God ain't going to get pissed and like shoot a lightning bolt down at you or anything. He says, no. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it suggests that your own conception, however inadequate, is sufficient to affect a first contact with God. And then it tells me in the big book that it is impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power. And to us, the realm of the Spirit is broad and roomy and all-inclusive. What he did is he had invited me to set aside what I thought I knew about God. I didn't know that it was the solution. I had no idea that this was going to be what was going to save my life. I just know I had an issue with it. Because, see, I didn't know. And it's the not knowing part that scared the hell out of me. And so he suggested me writing out my own conception of God. He said, write it like a one ad. Wanted, one higher power. It must be, you know. He says, put three words in there. The only three words I'm going to suggest to you, anything else is yours. He says, omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent. All knowing, all powerful, in all places. And then I added my own stuff, like, must love NCAA sports. I think they try harder. Must love real jazz, not that John Tesh Spyro Gyra crap. Must be willing to hurt my feelings to save my life. Crack me over the back of the head with a bat if it's going to keep me from jumping in the middle of traffic. Show up in music and literature and art. Show up in sunsets. Invited at all times. And I just started this conception of God that wasn't a condemning God. By the way, that's not what my parents' churches were telling me. That's just what I heard. You know, when you hear what you hear, and when it happens, it happens. Don gave me the opportunity to take God out of the box, you know. Or as a friend of my wife and I, he says, the God in my head was keeping me drunk. I had to get out of the God in my head and into the God of the universe, the bigger God, you know. I'm going to steal a line. My wife always says this, and I totally agree with it. I was alcohol's bitch. I really was. I had no say. I was alcohol's. I just was, yes, alcohol. Yes, alcohol. You know, I had no spine. I had no gumption. I had no say in the matter. I was the lowest of the low on the totem pole. I had to have a higher power, and I realized I already had one. It was alcohol. I needed a highest power. I needed a bigger power than alcoholism. And that's something that Don gave me. He says, you need a God that's bigger than your disease. Wow. I never stopped to really consider how powerful my disease was until that point. But I started writing it out. He says, cool. And I said, you want me to read it? He says, no, go home and pray to it. I was like, pray to a piece of paper? He says, no, pray to the conception of God that makes sense in your head. So I started praying to this God. That opened the door for a third step. You know, now I can tell you with all honesty, the first time I did the third step, it was really the idea that a three moves into 4 through 9. I've since come back to the third step many times in the course of doing the steps over the last 11 years. And the third step doesn't say that, you know. I have to see where I'm playing God, and I kept playing God in all these areas. I may try to manipulate and coerce and do this, but the most sinister form of me playing God is passing judgment. You know? Kind of like some of you guys are doing right now. That's totally cool. We're human. We're going to do it. The thing is I can't live on the decisions I make by passing judgment. I will condemn or criticize somebody, and they may be the person who's next in line to help save my life. They may be the hand of AA that reaches out. You know, me passing judgment has caused all sorts of resentment and insecurity and fear in my life. And I've, in the course of inventory over the last 11 years, I found just how sinister and deep-rooted that stuff is. You know? So I went and wrote this stuff down, and I can tell you with all honesty, it took me about 4.5-5 months to write my inventory. Actual writing time was about 6 hours. So I invite anybody who's sitting on a 4-step, finish it. Please, don't sit in that. It's like stepping in dog shit and then walking around your own house with it all day long. Because it's the thing about it. It's the darkest part of my soul. I'm going to where the pain lives. I'm going to where all the hatred is. I'm going to where all that guilt and shame and remorse lives. I'm going into the recesses of my soul, the darkest part, and I'm going to sit in there? Oh, man. This is a life and death errand, my book tells me. So what I've since going back through inventory, as I try to knock it out, one of my current two sponsors, like Bob C. up and coming, and Art H. over here in Midtown, last time I did inventory, Bob, he invited me up. I sat there all Friday night. I wrote till I was done. I spent the night. Saturday morning, we started on the fifth step. You know, and the cool thing is he taught me how to wipe my shoes at the door. And I learned that when I walk into inventory, I'm praying before I go in, God protect me as I walk in here. I don't need to take any of this anxiety back out into the world. I don't need to take it out of my wife. I don't need to take it out of my job or my friends or sponsees. I don't need to take it on my neighbors, but I'll easily do that because I'm restless, irritable, and discontented when I'm reliving all that old pain. I start thinking about them and I start thinking about it, and it frustrates me and it starts to fester in my own mind. Sitting on a 4-step isn't fun, man. So I did a 5th step with my then next sponsor was a gentleman by the name of Art Sutherland, who's out in Texas now. And Art and I sat down at the Atlanta Men's Workshop one afternoon, and we sat there until it was done. And we invited God to sit down with us. And I don't know if God sat on the stump that I invited him to sit on, but I can tell you a hawk landed on a branch right above our heads, and it stayed there for 6 hours. You know, now I'm not into the hawks thing. I got no problem with it. But to me, that was pretty cool. You know, I would throw some stuff out there, and I'd be like, man, he's still there. All right. You know, and then I was about to share that one thing. You know, the one thing you don't want to talk about. I'm going to take it to your grave. I don't have it written down. It's that one thing. And Art could sense that I was holding back. And he shared two things. And I couldn't believe he said it. He put two things out there that I thought for sure those lightning bolts are going to come down, or his head was going to explode, or he's going to start running for the hills to get away from me from having admitted it. Because there's no possible way you could say that and still be sitting here. And he did. And these tears started running down his face. And all of a sudden, man, I found out there's like 5 or 6 things I hadn't written down. And one of them was the church. And I shared with him that thing I shared with you about sitting in my mom's church, feeling isolated and alone, feeling unwelcome, feeling like I didn't belong. Like if I wasn't in that line of people going forward, God didn't want to be a part of me. And I bawled like a baby. I didn't realize how much that had affected me. And all of a sudden, this God got a lot bigger. And some of these fifth step promises, one of which is that we feel like we can look the world in the eye. If you were like me, I was a shoe guy. I wouldn't look you in the eye, because if I looked you in the eye, you'd see that I was scared. I'd look you in the eye, you'd see that I wasn't enough, that I didn't measure up, that I should be asked to leave because I got no business being here. And I could look the world in the eye after that. There's this freedom that came from just getting it out. Did I do a perfect fourth and fifth step? No. I've since learned. I don't know that there is a perfect fourth and fifth step. My experience is there's only one wrong one, and that's the one you don't do. So if anybody asks you and invites you to do inventory and to be free and rid of those things that have been blocking you from God Himself and others, man, you know what they're asking is, hey, brother, let me help you unburden your shoulders. Hey, man, why don't you come walk with me? Don't you want to walk a little lighter? Don't you want to feel the air just kind of embracing you? Don't you want to breathe in the Spirit? And at the time, my sponsor, Donna, had shared this. My mom had lost her kidneys, and I was explaining to him what the arterial sclerosis is. And anybody who's familiar with it, it's a clogging of the arteries through plaque buildup, and blood flow is restricted, and she lost a kidney through it. Well, he suggested to me, he goes, you got this spiritual cholesterol clogging up your system, my friend. Yeah. You got this spiritual cholesterol that's keeping your inability of God to flow freely through your life. And that four step was kind of like putting in a stent. That fifth step was like opening that bastard wide open. I started to feel and experience things that I hadn't felt and experienced before, and it blew my mind. Literally, blew my mind. I found myself sitting in meetings going, I have no idea why I'm in such a good mood. You know, people would be like, how you doing? I'm like, great. You know, they made me greeter, you know, and making coffee. You know, and then they would say, watch out for Proctor's coffee. It's fierce. You know, I was like, it's not the coffee, man. I love being alive and sober. And how long I had stymied that. How I'd stifled that ability to just be alive. And what's really cool is the circumstances didn't dictate my happiness. It wasn't because of a girlfriend or a new job or some money in my pocket. Had none of them. I just felt better. And I hear people talk about the pink cloud. And unfortunately, if I offend anybody, I'm so sorry. I really don't want to. I'll hear people say, oh, isn't it cute? They're on a pink cloud. I'm here to tell you 11 years later, I don't know how big this pink cloud is, but I'm still in it. I'm still in it. I still revel in the grace of God. I still get excited about sobriety. I love sharing this thing. I am a damn cheerleader for AA because y'all let me. Not everybody's excited about my message. Not everybody wants what I have. You know, they say like, dude, you are super sober. I don't want to be that sober. You know? But I can't help but express the experience I've had. When I did my fifth step and I moved into 6 and 7 and I said, these are the things which I've admitted, not the things my sponsor admitted, not the things the society has admitted, not what the Bible told me, not what the Quran told me, not what anybody told me. This is what I've admitted to myself. This is the crap that's blocking me. This is me kicking my own ass. And I realized that I could ask God to step in and remove it. And it was this amazing process. He could step in and remove it. And then I made a list in 8. Wasn't happy about it. My sponsor was. He tickled. He's like, keep writing, brother. All right, you know. But I moved into this experience with 9 and 10. And one of the amends I made in 9, because I owed my mom some money. And I really thought it was just the money I owed her. And any moms in here are going to appreciate this. As I slid that little piece of money across the table. Here you go, Mom. She pushed it back. Mom, don't you want the money? She goes, you don't even know how you hurt me, do you? She goes, 6 months in a row, I sat making phone calls, emails, letters, 4 different states, over 25 municipalities, hospitals, morgues, jails, prisons, trying to find me. Because, see, I pushed them out of my life so far that she couldn't find me. I'm going to bet that my mom probably aged 10 years in those 6 months. Sleepless nights, frantic, going to the doctors, having to be put on additional medications because I stressed her out so much. Because, see, that's how much she loved me. And my delusion is I'm sparing her the pain. I'm not harming anybody. After she shared that with me, she then took the money. But see, that face-to-face experience, that nothing can... Because, see, I really didn't know, you know. I moved into steps 10, 11, and 12, and I started to sponsor people. And I was less than a year when I started sponsoring people. And I would sit in meetings, and people would say, if anybody has more than a year and can be a sponsor, I couldn't raise my hand. My sponsor suggested I go to a different meeting. So I went to meetings where they invited people, if you had a 12-step experience, and you're willing to be a sponsor, raise your hand. Boom, my hand could go up. And I started sponsoring guys. And I'm the biggest joy of sobriety. Because, see, the 12 steps rendered me sober, relationship with God. Sobriety starts in sponsorship. That's where I get to enjoy sobriety. That's where I get to embrace sobriety. That's when I get to see the light come on in somebody's eyes, and I get to see them excited, and I get to see them pull themselves out of the grave. If we walk in here, we got one foot in. Unfortunately, man, sometimes the hand of AA isn't strong enough to pull and keep somebody here. You know, my sponsors have always loved me when I needed to be loved and kicked my ass when I needed to be kicked. Because sometimes I don't hear, please. You know, I needed to be told in some very humbling ways, you're screwing up, Christian. My sponsor, Bob Crawford, up and coming, I'll bust his anonymity because he is the meanest man in AA. I'm pretty sure of it. He'll say things to me, what are you currently doing that you shouldn't be doing? Damn. And what are you not doing that you should? And he gives me this barometer. Go figure, it's in step 10. You know, I keep looking at these steps, and I keep looking at this experience. But when I come back through the experience, I have a new experience. The 12 steps is a set of principles, spiritual in nature, which you practice the way of life, expel the obsession to drink, and enable me to become happily and easily whole. But it's not a one and done for me. I've done over 9 fourth steps. You know, I've been through the 12 steps in their entirety 7 times. I'm not done cooking yet. I definitely got issues. You can look at me and watch how animated I am. That boy's got issues. You know, but I'm less issued than I used to be. You know, and I love sharing the big book. I love watching somebody's eyes open and realize that this is a textbook, that this is a program. You know, it's just like getting a gym membership. Coming to AA is just like getting a gym membership. Working the 12 steps is allowing us to get on the machines and work out. A lot of people get memberships and they never work out. And they wonder why everybody's getting stronger and fitter and healthier. I'm here to suggest, follow me. I know how to get on the machine. Follow me. I know how to do this thing. You know, I'm not the best at it, and I'm not the most desirable person to work with. I'm a tough sponsor to have because I give a shit. I don't just give you assignments and then hope you call me. No, I have invested in people's lives. And because y'all taught me how to do that, you invested in mine. And one of the gifts of that is doing 12-step study. I lead big book studies. I started doing it when I was about a year and a half sober. I was the reader. I was the Charlie of the Joe and Charlie. I was the reader. And in reading the big book, I learned a whole lot about the big book from many different teachers. And my wife and I are currently doing a big book study over at a place in Sandy Springs. And we love the experience. But it's in carrying this message. And I love Domino's delivers. We carry. We carry. If you want it, you'll take it. Domino's will stand there and waste their money. I carry the message. If you want it, you'll take it. If you don't, you won't. And that's okay. But what we can do is we can plant that seed of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it may take 10 years for it to start to sprout. But some of us... just takes longer. Carrying the big book study, I was over in a place, Sumter, South Carolina, over at a place called Any Length Recovery a couple of years back, back in 2010. And this really cute blonde walked up to me, and she had a big book in her hand. And to me, there's nothing sexier than that. You know, she asked a question, and instead of posing my ego and trying to throw out all my knowledge, I just shared my experience honestly. They quote a number of people in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, Silkworth, Bill Wilson being the primary author. They give a tribute to quote the back to Herbert Spencer, and the Reinhold Niebuhr is in there with the Serenity Prayer. But Henry Ford is quoted as saying that experience is the thing of supreme value. And when we share our experience, we're coming from a place of saying, hey, join me. This is what I did, instead of teaching or talking. When I teach or talk, I isolate myself. When I share, I'm saying, this is what I did. If you want it, come get it. But my wife and I courted. You can Google it, courted. It's not dating. We courted. She lived in Sumter. I lived here. We got to know each other and fell in love with each other 180 miles apart. I fell in love with her before I ever touched her. That's God's plan. The physical has always been easy for me. But God's plan was I was going to get to know a woman who was going to drive up my phone bill, by the way, because we talked all the damn time. And she worked third shift and I worked first shift. So I never got any sleep because, you know, I'm calling her. And she came here and stood still in front of God and everybody else, knowing fully well what she was about to do and with whom she was about to do it, said that she would marry me. That blew my mind. It's the purest, healthiest relationship I've ever known in my life. I run into people on a regular basis. They're like, dude, I got rid of the ball and chain. Let's do something. It's like, I don't have that experience. Now, I know I've only been married for 2.5 years, but my experience in 2.5 years is I'm not tired with it yet. And we practice principles in our home. We attended a 12-step tradition study to learn how to practice traditions in a relationship. You know, we practice a certain amount of Al-Anon in our home as well. But we love AA. We're both cheerleaders for AA. And when she spoke here a couple months ago, I was so excited to see her share her passion with you of Alcoholics Anonymous, because, you know, next to the common cold, I'm thinking enthusiasm may be the most contagious thing. I'm pretty sure it's second. But all you have to do is be around it. You may not understand what that person has, but you're maybe aware of the fact that you don't currently possess it. Two things and I'll wrap up. I appreciate y'all's patience with me. I saw a guy get up once in front of a meeting, and this is when I decided I was going to be excited about AA. I saw him get up in front of a group, and he went like this. He went, does anybody want what I have? No. That's all you got, brother. No. I thought he was nodding out, man. It was scary. Man, we get excited. Because, see, they may not know what you got, but they know they don't have it. They know they don't possess it. And you may not necessarily want what I have, but there's a lot of people who are pretty damn sure they don't want what they currently have. And a lot of people have had the 12-step experience and want to have a new experience. And there's so many cool avenues to do it. And this is the last thing. And I hope that I've effectively done this tonight. The book says we can only clear the ground a bit. And I'm going to put this in first person. If my testimony helps you to sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway, capital B, capital H. The book says with this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Guys, thank you so much. Bless you.
Thanks, Christian. That was awesome. I appreciate you sharing experience, strength, and hope, and excitement with us here. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say that was an 11. Stories go to 11 at NABA. Okay, let's...
I walked uphill, but it's been walked before. Till that hill got flat and now I won't have to fight it no more. Somehow, someway, I'll win my fight someday. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway. And we'll all be together on that broad highway.